You're probably wrong, and you don't know where you're wrong.
Welcome to Thinking Deeply About Primary Education, the podcast that makes time and space to think about pedagogy, teaching and learning, professional development, anything of interest to time poor but enthusiasm rich primary teachers. This week, I'm joined by Richard Selfridge. Hi, Richard.
Hello there. Hi.
It's great to have you back. I mean, it's been a while since you were on with Jamie talking about assessment. What have you been up to in the months since we last met?
Yeah, so the last time Jamie Pembroke and I were discussing assessment, Jamie and I have been working even more closely together to the point that I've now joined him working with Insight Tracking to do more of the kinds of things which I've been doing for the last while, which is a lot of data consultancy. So education data consultant, working with schools, with MATs, with organizations, just trying to help people who are aware that they would like to make improvements to their use of data and just need professional guidance within that. And so I say I'm going to be doing some more of that for Insight, as well as also continuing the other work which Jamie and I have done. We've been podcasting ourselves. We run the Data Buses podcast, but we also run conferences. We run training. We run assessment days. And so doing a lot more of that and doing it alongside Insight, who, again, you know, do a lot of work in that area, helping people to manage their data. So, yes, so I'm a few changes. I'm doing, working with Insight, and but continuing a few other things that I'm doing as well.
I am extremely jealous that Insight managed to call their big event Disco. You know, that's quite the coup.
Oh, that took us quite a while. We liked the fact that we could come up with it because we knew. I mean, some people, I don't know who these people are, but they think discussing data is tedious. I heard a wonderful discussion with Stuart Ritchie on his fantastic podcast, which I can highly recommend. Where they were talking about statistical significance and suggesting that people would find this boring. Anyway, but clearly data is a bit of an interesting one. So Jamie and I decided that we needed to have something to say. Well, we'd like to have a conference, like a day, which is just not just the two of us, other people as well. So Josh Perry is involved, and we invite people in the areas where we do the conferences. But we needed a good name. So yes, the Data in Schools Conference, shortened to Disco, that won the name game.
Yeah, it's going to take some beating. Absolutely. So our focus is going to be on uses of student data, because I know that's something you've been spending a lot of time thinking about recently. And I think in my experience, student data gets misused in many ways. And again, in my experience, causing adverse workload in many instances. What are some of the common errors or misuses that we as teachers and school leaders should be aware of?
Yes, I think, again, there are lots of things that people think about data and about numbers, about information, that are, when you question teachers, those working in schools and wider organisations, about their understanding of assessment and of data. They often you find that people are working on sometimes false premises, or they're just unsure, they're uncertain. I think there's a useful analogy here with when we're teaching in primary, we're often, in secondary too, but in primary, we're always thinking about, well, what misconceptions might pupils have here? How do I deal with those misconceptions? And I think it's worth thinking about that data in those ways as well. What misconceptions might people have, and what mistakes might they make? And there are a number of things, I think. You know, we've moved on in primary in England from a system that was very criterion-based. So we had big, long lists of things that we would be ticking off to see whether children had achieved certain things, or at least we thought children had achieved certain things, because all we could see was performance, and we were having to try and make our best teacher assessments, which can also sometimes be best guesses as to what children might do. So we've moved on from that, although there's still a remnant of that in the system. And we've moved to the situation now where lots of people are using standardized assessments and are using those. And again, I have a lot of time for well-administered standardized assessments. But I think one of the things here is there's a really useful piece published recently by Sam Sims. Some of your listeners, other listeners may know, who's a great researcher and does lots of different things for lots of the big research bodies. But he wrote a piece which is called, it's got a great title, A Proposal for Saving 5 Million Hours Per Year, One Day Per Teacher of Workload Without Harming Pupil Achievement. But again, I love the fact that in that, Sam, basically, he looks at some really useful things. And I think these are the things to consider. You can standardized assessments are very useful. You get a standardized score from a standardized assessment. But because of the legacy of progress, people want to look at one standardized score and another standardized score and say, well, how has a child progressed using these things? Now, there are ways that you can give some kind of indication as to the change that might have happened for a pupil. But Sam's blog is really useful. He kind of talks through some of the really good research that we have. FFT Data Lab did a really good post looking at, well, how much change is there? Particularly at a termly level, from one term to the next, in a standardized score in primary. And it's really useful. This is something which I talk to the schools I work with a lot to say, you would expect there to be not a great deal of change for most pupils. And that's what turned out to be the case. For some pupils, there is change. And for those pupils, it's interesting. The question is, how much change is there for a pupil? And at what point is that interesting? And Sam actually puts some numbers on it, which I think is useful. He suggests that based on some other research from the Education Endowment Foundation, that really, a pupil's score, it can change about 13-point range, over a 13-point range you can look at. So it could be all the way up and all the way down because of the measurement error, which is inherent within standardized assessments, which again, most of the people I work with in schools often aren't aware of that measurement set and error that's inherent there. So Sam basically says, well, how many children do actually make detectable change from one term to the next, from the autumn to the spring? And he says, it's maybe 7% of pupils. And if you look at from the autumn to the summer, a longer period of time, even then, it's still only about 6% of pupils make a change, which you could say, within certain parameters, was a meaningful change. So I think that kind of thing is the thing where people need to think about their use of data. Are you using standardized assessments on a termly basis, for example? Are you actually using that to work out what children have learned or what they know, or these things that you might make assumptions that you're doing? Or are you just really using it as a performance management tool or a teacher management tool? And is that the best use of data? Because as Jamie Pembroke will tell you, you can either get good data or you can use it for performance management. So again, I think there's a number of things there to consider that you really need to think about. What inferences can we make, and how much time and effort are we going to spend collecting this information?
I think the time and effort is massive because I know that it feels like it's all schools shut down for a week for assessment, 3 times a year, and that's not including the actual statutory national assessments. So there's probably quite a big investment. And like you say, using data were in ways that are likely to impact on people's performance management, even though lots of schools are moving away from that kind of idea, probably still happens quite a lot. Just by the nature of the bubble we're in. So I think it's, when I read Sam's blog, I was like, oh, again, everyone needs to read this. Everyone needs to hear this message.
It's a really big piece which I've been pushing a lot. I think it's really useful. Exactly, and primary schools, I say, because I say historically we've wanted to capture some kind of data. At least we're doing it termly now. And again, the good news is that 5 years ago there were still a lot of primary schools that were doing things more than termly, 6 times a year, or often more often than that. But at least now, we've got fairly good data from TeacherTap to suggest that most primaries are now doing it once a term. But as you say, in that once a term, how much time is being spent on it? I do think it is useful to collect information, but with the schools that I've worked with and the organisations I've worked with for the longest, I'm encouraging them to get to the point where they're only assessing maybe twice a year, because they've got a lot of data. They can see that the changes, you can't detect a great deal of change using a standardised assessment, and any test a change that you do see, you can't make too many assumptions from those changes that you do see. So if you can move to that point, and you can be a data confident school and say, it's fine, we will assess our pupils in, let's say, typical through primary in year one, and then in year two, and then in year three. So by year four, we've got 3 years worth of data now. We've also got all the teacher assessments because we're going to ask teachers to assess, but that can be a relatively streamlined process. So you can do that. So you can begin to just take control of your data. Understand, it is really useful to have standardized assessment. But you don't want too much of it because of Sam's blog, for example.
Do you think there are any parallels with the move away from what's known as triple marking? In as much as once schools took the leap of faith, they didn't notice any discernible difference, and actually you save time and can be more impactful. Do you notice that with the schools that do make that leap?
I think so, yes. And for the similar kind of reason, once you understand, triple marking, again, I wrote a piece on it a while ago, and it was quite a thing, but it came in because of that sort of fear, and people wanted to demonstrate what they were doing to outside bodies effectively. And that's a little bit of some of the work that's or some of the workload that's been that we've had within data is because it's been used as an audit function. So I think there's a bit of that. But I think once people understand a little bit more about, for example, the design of a standardized assessment, I talk about this a lot when we do discos and we do other things. If it's a well-designed standardized assessment, then it's designed, again, and my key thing here is the items, the questions on the assessment, they're designed to differentiate between pupils. And the key question they're asking is, are you the type of child who can answer this question correctly? They're curriculum informed, but they're not actually trying to work out whether the child knows that bit of information. They're not diagnostic in that way. And a lot of schools mistake them for being diagnostic tests. Now, you understand that as a teacher, you want to know whether a child knows something you've taught them or whether they can do something you've taught them. But a standardized assessment isn't the best way or even a particularly effective way of doing that. There are other things that you can do as a teacher that help you to understand what your pupils can do and can't do and what they know and what they don't know. So I think I think that the time has come for people to just investigate these things a bit more, understand a bit more, which is why Jamie and I, we wrote Data Proof Your School, which is a book aimed at leadership in school, really. And there's a whole section there about the limitations of assessment so that you understand these things, so that you don't spend a huge amount of time, entering ones and zeros into a spreadsheet to try and get some question level analysis, which is probably not very effective use of your time.
Of those standardized assessments available, do you have a preference, or is the quality much the same because their samples are reasonably large?
There are certain ones which I like. Again, it's a really interesting history as to how they've developed as well. And there's something which I found fascinating of late, because again, standardized assessments were, and we to be, we have them in English, sorry, in reading and in maths, really. You can get them in a couple of other subjects, the hierarchical subject, but not many. But we're talking about reading and maths. And if you go back to 10 years ago, there weren't that many standardized assessments that were available in schools. And most of those were annual ones, because schools were assessing in different ways because of the levels framework. So they were assessing in different ways. But then as soon as levels went away, a whole bunch of companies started producing termly tests because that's what schools wanted. So that's an interesting bit of, once you understand that, you think, okay, so why the termly tests? Is that because that's the best thing to do? Because before there was all this focus on standardized assessments, we were just doing them once a year. But in the transition out of levels, we began doing them 3 times a year. So there's some things to be said there. I think there's a couple of things that my main things, I don't really have a big preference about them, because looking at them, if it's a well-standardized assessment, if it's, reasonably well aligned to the curriculum, so it should be testing roughly what the children know. It gives you a good indication as to whether children are achieving within the broader curriculum or not. So I don't have too many issues with that. Some of them are, more tightly designed. So some of the assessments tend to be use a lot of questions items from the current year. And so you hear for some assessments that people will say, "Oh, these aren't very good at assessing my pupils who have special educational needs, disabilities." Or who English is an additional language or some additional learning need. Because often these tests are quite skewed towards the current year because schools want to use them diagnostically, even though they're not designed to do that, but that's how they want to use them. Other assessments will be a little bit less weighted towards the current year, and they'll be a bit more, all the assessments will tend to be have a number of items from this year's curriculum and previous year's curriculum. But some of the other ones have a broader spread. So it depends on where you are as a school. I don't have a real preference. My main plea to people is that you actually read the rubric. You understand what the test provider tells you about, particularly about the timing of assessments. I work with a lot of schools who say, "Oh, we do this particular assessment and we do it this particular time. And we do it at this time, usually, the week or two after half term, because somebody wants to put some numbers into a spreadsheet." And then you look into the rubric of the assessment and you realize that the assessment is designed to assess the whole term's learning because it's quite geared towards this term. So therefore it has some items in that you haven't covered in your curriculum yet. So I think rather than saying that one assessment is better than another, it's I just urge people to read the rubric, understand when the assessment should actually be administered, because that will it will just as with all standardized assessment, the standardization is important. You have to kind of you've got to follow the process to get good results.
The I we haven't covered this yet comes up quite a lot in conversations, and teachers sometimes will ask me which, or leaders will say, "Well, we're looking at assessment. What should I get in?" And so I think that look at the rubric advice is going to be my default go-to, because there are too many reasons why you could choose one thing over over another.
And the other thing is, read the rubric, make a choice, and then once you've chosen an assessment, try and stick with it as long as you can. Assessments they do degrade over time. There's various issues. If people have never heard about the Flynn effect, they should go and find out about the Flynn effect. Guess what? People are getting cleverer over time in the Western world and the world generally, as the world becomes more complex. However, if you can use an assessment, select an assessment and use it, and do it for 3, 5, 7, 10 years even. You will you'll, the information will become increasingly useful to you because you'll just have a bigger body of data which you can then analyze and use. It worries me that I work with lots of schools and go into lots of schools and you ask schools about what they're doing and what they're doing is something which they've started doing recently. And you want these things to be bedded in, particularly assessment, you want it to get bedded in because there are so many benefits to doing that.
I mean, it would be amazing to see that, and to see if anyone actually was tracking. So, if anyone's listening and they want to talk about their experience of using the same system for 10-ish years, let us know. In your opinion, how should student data be used? What should be collected, and can a balance be struck between time and impact?
Yes, I think it is it's a key thing, isn't it? I say, for those who aren't aware of the work which I've done for the last 10 years, I've been talking about data. About 10 years ago, I just started writing and talking and to some extent ranting about data and data use because I was so amazed what people were doing and thinking. And for a long time, people were really interested in any alternatives. They just wanted to stick doing what they were doing. But for the last while, I've been really focusing, okay, so what should we actually be doing? What would be useful? And I think the key thing here, I probably distill it down to what you really need to do is to move on from a progress mindset where you're looking at point A, point B, and you're saying that they were measured and they were 17 at this point, and now they're 22, and that's a difference. So moving away from that progress mindset and moving to an action mindset and trying to understand, okay, so what are we actually doing? We're all familiar with the fact that the whole Ofsted so what thing at the moment, but what are you actually doing as a result of this data? And the widespread observation seems to be that for a long time, a lot of data was collected, it was put into a box somewhere or a file, and not very much happened. And I think we need to move over that. So in terms of how student data should be used, I think the key thing is to be thinking about building pictures over time and not looking at these little snapshots of the last time we took a photograph of them were here and now they're here. If you're a year five teacher, you should know more than what their last result in year four was. You should know what these children did, in if you still you'll probably still have key stage one results from year two at the moment. What happened there? What happened to the phonic screening check? What happened to these children in reception? What happened in their early learning goals? You should be able to look back to that if you need to. And for some pupils, you probably do need to because those pupils are complex and you need to try and understand where the gaps might be or what their learning needs might be. So you need to build a picture over time. And I think that's the key thing about thinking about pupils more holistically and then trying to work out, okay, which of these pupils are actually they're fine. They're doing really well in school. They're here, they're in class, they're doing what we want to do in class. And every time we check them, they seem to be okay because that's the case for most pupils. Most pupils are doing well in our schools. We know that there's lots and lots of evidence to say that the vast majority of pupils are fine. They're doing really well, and we should acknowledge that and then move on because we don't need to spend a lot of time in a pupil progress meeting or in a discussion about anything about the pupils who are great. Which of you pupils don't we need to worry about? Great. Which pupils do we need to have a think about? We've got a few pupils who are at the pupil number of pupils who are at the front end of things, and for some reason, whenever if you do a standardized assessment, these are the children who are knocking out of the park. They're getting 115 plus in assessments. That's great. In primary, I'm not quite sure what you do with them, and I'm always interested in hearing what people do with children who are at that ahead of the pack. I'm always interested to know whether those pupils are the oldest in the class, Because that's an interesting question. So therefore, age data is really useful, particularly in primary, particularly as when the children are younger, but all the way through to year six, it's useful. So I think it's that sort of building a picture, move all the fine pupils, recognize who they are, and say they're great. All of our curriculum work that we've done, and everybody's done huge amounts of work on that, that's working for them. But these pupils, it's not working for. And then building up that picture and then drilling into it and saying, okay, so what gaps might this child have? Which areas have they struggled with? What have they got better at? And how did they get better at it? Might that help another child in this class or one of the other classes or in one of the other cohorts? So it's that kind of thing. It's building pictures and figuring out who isn't succeeding within the curriculum, and then working out what are we actually going to do? And then that's the so what thing. What are we actually going to do about it?
Fantastic. It reminds me of what Chris always talks about reading, and when there's a, I don't know, almost like a tendency to assume that phonics hasn't worked. When actually, if you think about the reading rope and the different elements of reading, it's almost like being really forensic about what might be going on with these pupils. Almost like, is that the sort of parallel you're drawing, like to get that far
Absolutely.
down into where we, how can we help these pupils?
Exactly. Once you realize I don't have to worry about all of the pupils in my class, I'm only really, I've got a class of 30, let's say, I'm only really having to drill down into six, seven, maybe eight, around about that number of pupils. But for those pupils, you should be spending a bit of time and really thinking, okay, so what is it, as you say, understanding the reading rope, understanding those different areas of reading, understanding the different elements of, the core subjects, writing and maths particularly. And then thinking, okay, so what is it that we need to do? What can we change here for so that this pupil has the opportunity to learn the things we want to learn, or that they get the support to help them to develop the independence that they need to be able to learn? So it's those kinds of things, because all pupils are individuals. We've now hopefully got to the point where people realize that there's no such thing as a special needs child, and you can't group special needs children. All you can say is this whole group of children, they have some additional needs, but all those needs are separate. So we have to get down at individual level and work out what we're going to do for the individuals. There are ways that you can support those individuals that I think are more effective than others. And often that is to try and put that support in class as much as possible. So you make changes at timetable level and at curriculum level. And you say, okay, for this year four class, for example, so current year fives, for example, who were out of school during the pandemic. So they missed a lot of phonics teaching. So whilst they've probably learned to read, and whilst the majority of them, I've been teaching a year five class recently, most of the children have got through it and they've worked out and they're doing okay. But there are still big gaps in there, and you can kind of see their big gaps in there. So you need to go in there, and for that year five class, they needed actually to have within their timetable, they need some timetabled curriculum, phonics curriculum. So they actually need to understand, how we join the letters together and how these different sounds work together, and so on. So you need to think about it at that level, so what changes can we make and what can we do?
I mean, that makes total sense. And as a maths person as well, thinking about which bit of maths is it that actually unlocks the rest, because I think you mentioned earlier on, the hierarchical subjects do well with the assessments, and maths being that almost linear journey. You can, when I talk to secondary sort of heads of maths, they always talk about how they go to year five maths when pupils are struggling in secondary school. And actually, I say that, well, no, you need to go way, way further back, because year five is the hardest maths in the primary curriculum.
Yeah, exactly. The thing which I say is, basically, all the way up to year four, you're working with whole numbers pretty much. And, and children should be, by the end of year four, they really have got the idea with whole numbers. Once you get into year five, suddenly you get into the whole bit of where you say, yeah, but that's not the whole picture, children. There's bits of numbers. And there's some of these numbers that are on the wrong side of zero, just to everybody's point of view. And then, yeah, you're quite right. It gets all quite complicated. And it's very hard to understand fractions of all kinds, decimals, fractions and percentages and so on. If you're not rock solid in calculation, in number, in shape space, those kinds of things.
I mean, it feels like this kind of shift actually shouldn't take too much effort from schools. I mean, when you're working with people, do you find they need to make wholesale changes, or can they just tweak things to get towards the point where actually they're being more effective in their practice?
It's a gradual change. Again, and I've done enough work with schools to understand that you need to be really clear what changes you're going to make, and have a timetable for them that is feasible, and that you don't make wholesale changes. It's the whole Chesterton's fence thing. where don't remove something if you don't quite understand why it was put there to start with. And making wholesale changes without really having thought about the consequences is tricky. Again, there's a great EF bit of guidance that came out recently about managing change in schools that I think is really useful. It builds on the assess, plan, do, review cycle, which we're all familiar with. But basically says a similar kind of thing. You need to work out what it is you want to change. You need to make sure that you then put some change in place and then assess whether it's worked and so on. So when I work with people, I say don't change a lot of things, but there's a few things you need to do. There's a few you want high quality data, so you're going to need to work out what data you need. What do you actually need? This will be a wider set of data than you've probably been using because you'll have been encouraged to just focus on progress, pretty much. You'll have forgotten about the fact that summer-born children are systematically different from autumn-born children, because we forget about that. It's amazing how often that happens. There'll be all kinds of other bits of information that you might not have focused on. The fact that a child might have had a medical issue 3 years ago that's not captured in your system anywhere, and therefore the teachers further up the school just, are not able, well, they don't understand that. So a child's got misconceptions because they've missed some schooling or they weren't able to focus as much. So those kinds of things, I think. But no, the things that when I'm working with schools is to say, you should really, there are good standardized assessments for maths and for reading. So you should really get those sorted out. You should think about what you're doing with writing. There are ways of assessing writing that are more efficient. You should certainly look at no more marking and consider whether you're going to do some kind of comparative judgment. In the foundation subjects, there are other things that you can do so that you can see development over time. Not progress over time, development. Are these people sticking with the curriculum? Are they able to do more? Do they know more? All those things that often talk about. So I think there's a number of things there, but at the same time, you also have to work out, well, what's actually working in the school? Because one teacher or one department or one group, one cohort, they might be working really well and they might have some really effective practices that they can share with colleagues. So I think it's that sort of gradual process of just basically saying to people, what are you doing at the moment? What do you want to do? How are you going to get to where you want to be? And supporting them through that.
I think that'll both be really reassuring and really helpful for leaders who are considering these changes to know that actually it sounds very manageable. I mean, just on the whole summer born, what did we discuss Malcolm Gladwell's? I know Malcolm likes to round off the edges. Did we discuss his hockey players and footballers
Yeah,
in?
we have done. No, we didn't do last time. But again, it's a really indicative and it illustrates the issue really well. You've read the piece about the ages of professional hockey players in the States, ice hockey players. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, I think whenever I read Outliers, that was one of the. It's just sort of, you're making connections between what you're reading and what you do on a daily basis. And it's like, wow, yes,
The basic, the argument that Gladwell uses using a lot of data is to say if you look at professional hockey players in the National Hockey League in the States, a huge number of them, more than 50% of them, are born in the first quarter of the year. And part of the reason for that is because they're put into a cohort. They're the oldest children, so they're the biggest children usually, physically bigger. As a group, they're physically bigger. Individuals, again, none of this is about individuals, it's about a group. So as a group, they're bigger than other children. And because they're bigger, they're probably stronger, they're probably more able to do things. So they look like they're better. So the key thing is that they start to get better coaching. They start to get better coaching relatively early on. So that by the time these hockey players are 14, 15, 16, they've had much, much more intensive coaching from more highly qualified coaches. They've played with other hockey players who've had good coaching. So they've played at a higher level. So that by the time they get to 16, they're so much better as a group than the autumn born, particularly the winter born, the last quarter of the year, the last quarter of the year, those born there. That isn't to say that there are some hockey players from that last quarter. There definitely are, but they're anomalies. They're unusual. And it's exactly the same in a class in school. It's really worth knowing who's the oldest, who's the youngest, what's the rank order in your class. And you would expect the older children to be able to do more and know more because they've been around longer. And you would expect the younger children to know less and to be able to do less. It's not rock solid at individual level. You get loads of brilliant summer-born children and loads of children in the autumn born who struggle. But understanding the population trends helps you to begin to understand this is. It's not difficult information to collect. It's basically within your school system. So bring it in, do some very quick analysis, and then you've got some good questions to ask.
You'll soon publish, and I think I misremembered this once. It's like it's a guide to using student data. What's the
That's right.
official title?
It's a little guide to using student data. So
Little
yeah, I've
guide.
written a couple of books for Sage, and they have a they've got a really great strand. It's really there's some brilliant little books, which are called Little Guides too, and which I can highly recommend. They're really good, but they're quite short books. They're quite nuggety, and they're aimed at busy teachers.
What prompted you to write the book, and what do you hope it will achieve?
Yeah, so the book which I've written is a little guide to using student data, which is published June this year, June 2024. And it was prompted because, so I've written a couple of books. The first book I wrote was called Data Bus Busting for Schools. And largely it was a big thing saying, stop using statistical significance badly, please, Ofsted. This is terrible. It's not making it, you know, you're misusing things and it's misdirecting people. And they're spending a huge amount of time on things which are not helpful to pupils. So that was largely written at kind of a policy level. I mean, it's just still a great book and I still recommend it. The beginning and the end, the middle's got lots of maths, but you might find that interesting. I like maths. But that book was quite mathsy and lots of people in school said, we don't have time to read it. So the second book, which I wrote with Jamie Pembroke, is Data Proof Your School. And that's firmly aimed at busy head teachers, busy senior leaders who just want to, okay, so I want to understand the problem. I want to understand some of the wider issues. And then I want to understand what I can do. And effectively, it's a how-to guide to data-proofing your school, which is to say, to take control of your data, to use your data to actually make differences for children in schools, which is what that's about. So having done those, the thing which I've been wanting to do for a long time, now that I've got to the point where people, again, you feel that you're pushing against a little bit of an open door, where people recognize, well, actually, yeah, we could be using this data more efficiently. We could be, rather than feeling hostile about data, which is certainly how I felt about the way it was being used in the 2010s. People got a bit more open. So I talked to Sage about doing something which said, okay, let's have a practical guide for teachers to say this is the kind of thing you should do. So there's a number of things which I think, you know, as a working teacher, lots of teachers use things. This is my little anecdote for this. You speak to a lot of secondary school teachers who often say to you, kind of joking, when you're in the pub or somewhere in a, you know, a relaxed social environment, what is it that you teach these children in primary school? How come they turn up here? There's a whole bunch of them. You know, they can't use capital letters. They can't write sentences. What's the problem here? Now, I thought about this at great length, and I kind of thought, actually, I wonder, is this related to something which I'm aware of in the classroom, which is that for a lot of pupils, they just don't quite know what the letters look like. So that's a it's a key thing. You know, it's like we talk about misconceptions and, you know, things something you might just not have learned. If you don't know what a capital Q looks like, then you can't write that down. You know, if you're not sure what, you know, a capital H looks like, then you're not going to write a capital H. You're going to write a lowercase h because you probably see more lowercase h's and you're probably used to writing the lowercase alphabet. You don't probably use capital letters too much. So therefore, it's a really useful thing, I think, as a teacher. And I think it's essential that you know which of the children in your class don't quite know the alphabet yet. It's amazing how many children in primary, I mean, it's a huge number, but it'll be 10 to 20% of a class where they don't know the alphabet song or they've forgotten it. They don't know the order of the letters. They can get up to maybe I and J. And then after that, I don't know if this is your experience. Some of them, it falls apart. So I think it's a key bit of information. Now you can capture that information quite easily. And whenever I work with classes, I always get the children, particularly in an English book, any book that involves writing, in the back page, one of the earliest tasks they ask them to do as a do now type task is just write the alphabet, lowercase, uppercase, and then write the numerals as well. You usually have to explain what numeral means because they don't know what that is. But then get them to write those as well. And again, I don't know, I think I've yet to meet a primary school teacher who doesn't recognize the fact that a lot of pupils' letter formation is either inefficient or inaccurate. And that's the key. And I think this is why when children get into year seven, year eight, and they don't use capital letters, it's because they don't know what they look like. So that's key information. And it's a really simple bit of information that you can get. And I think this is the kind, that's the kind of, it's, there's lots of little things like that in the using student data where these are quick, easy bits of data that you can gather. You don't need to collate this information. It doesn't need to be put into any system. You know, nobody in senior leadership needs to see this. But you as a teacher should know there are certain things that I should be doing. I should be checking their alphabet. I should be checking their numerals. I should check, you know, whether they know, you know, the names of common shapes in maths, those kinds of things. You know, there's lots of little things. Do they know what the standard algorithms are for, addition, subtraction, multiplication, division. And as they go through school, do they know them that are appropriate at their age level? And just ask the children, get them to do it, and then work out most of them will be fine, but the ones who aren't, you need to know now. So I think those are the kind of the key things which has made me think in terms of, what we should do. But then there are other things as well. I think as well, as a teacher, you need to understand a little bit about, how you should gather data in, what data you should have at your fingertips. So if you're a year four teacher, you should have phonics screening check scores. You should have access to early learning goals information. You should be able to see which of the pupils in your class were great, were not great, and you should have some sense as to how things have changed over time. But then you also need summaries of those, and you need to make sure that you. I'm a huge fan of an annotated seating plan, and actually putting useful information onto your seating plan that you're going to use to help you to understand your class. And the key thing I think is, imagine that you had a supply teacher who's going to teach your class for a day. Now, in primary your class inside out, all of the little issues, the friendship issues, who's left-handed, who wears glasses, who doesn't like wearing their glasses, so probably isn't wearing their glasses. Who doesn't like writing with their left hand, so this week has decided to write with their right hand. All these little bits of information about your class. Which child was ill for 6 months in year two, because you should have found out that information. So you've got a supply teacher who comes into your class. How are they going to know which of the children they really need to be aware of? Because most of the children will be fine, but some of them need something extra. And it's that, I think it distills down to that. If somebody else is going to teach your class, what would they need to have at their fingertips? Because that's what you need to be always working towards.
So, is the idea that if enough teachers have this information, then you can drive system change upwards? And I ask this as someone who feels like they were banging their head against the wall sometimes in school. Is that your plan? Is that your hope?
Well, it's kind of wider than that. Yes. So there's a whole bunch of kind of really, I think, key things that teachers in classrooms should be doing so that they can generate the information which they need to understand. It's all about that formative information, about trying to figure out what can they actually do. What have I seen them doing? What can I get them to show me that they can do? So I'm aware that they've learned it. It's all about, using do now tasks. It's about using the things that are quick, easy, all of this, all of the research that we have into retrieval practice, for example, it's embedding those kinds of things. So it's that. But it's also, there's a bit in the book about helping classroom teachers who probably haven't had time to read Data Proof Your School or do much training on standardized assessment. There's a bit in there about the benefits and the limitations of standardized assessments. There's a bit about understanding issues to do with, the questions around question level analysis and so on. So hopefully the teachers can be empowered to say, I actually, is this a reasonable use of this information? Is this a reasonable use of this data? So this one, I say, is very much aimed at just supporting those in class. And I think, the more that teachers in classroom teachers become confident or more confident with their data use, the more that they'll be able to question some of the things which might be being pushed down on.
When you wrote your first book, did you have in mind that you would hit almost these three essential sort of pillars of
Well, I
the
do remember when I wrote the
ecosystem?
first book, right, sort of around about that time, I'd done quite a lot of work with David Dydow and had lots of conversations with him. And he was always interested in saying, so what should we do? And I was saying, yeah, but David, until people recognize that there's a problem, there's not much point saying to them, you need to really take. I started off quite early on saying, why do people not use age data in primary school? It just doesn't make any sense to me at all. Why do we not really do it? So, for example, you should know these things. I sort of started doing that, but it turned out that actually people was quite so embedded and wedded to the idea that we could measure progress that you just needed a lot of work to help people to understand why that was problematic and why the assumptions that they were making were not reasonable assumptions. Yes, it was kind of always at the back of my mind to say, how can we do that? How can we do this? And it's, I say, so I think there are lots of things that you can do in classroom and that you want to almost reclaim data as being a positive thing. Because again, I've been teaching 20 years, and for those of us who've been around that length of time longer, data did become a bit of a cudgel that people were using. And so it got a bad name, and people were a bit afraid of it or disliked it or suspicious of it. And I don't think that's the case. I say this at discos all the time. You can't teach in England without assessing your pupils. But everything that we do is based, you have to assess your pupils. Teacher assessment is vital. You're probably wrong, and you don't know where you're wrong, so you need some kind of independent ways of checking to see whether you're wrong or not. But you can't teach in England without assessment. We're not France, where, famously, it's still a bit the case this, but famously, De Gaulle would say that he knew what children were learning at any given point on a Tuesday in April. I can't remember exactly what the quote was, because that's how they teach, or they used to teach in France. They've changed slightly, but it's still very much a dictated system there. Whereas here, as a teacher, you're expected to understand your class and to teach them accordingly. And I think it's key that you get that information. So yeah, so I've always wanted to focus on better use of data in the classroom. So it's nice to finally get to the point where I've managed to just distill all of this and put it into an easily readable guide, which you can sit down and read in the afternoon. It's not a long one.
When should teachers expect to be able to access it or buy it?
But yeah, so it's due to be published next month, so I'm expecting probably by the 3rd week of June it should be available. It'll certainly be available for the beginning of the new term, and for loads of keen people will be able to read it over the summer, I'm hoping. I'm really looking forward to seeing the feedback from it, because again, I'm hoping that other people will say, oh, actually, yeah, the thing which I do is this. Something which I say I've researched fairly extensively on this one, talked to lots of people about what they do in the classroom, but it'll be interesting to see what response it gets.
I imagine there will be a fantastic response on that, and I think you can look forward to lots of the if a book's going well during the summer, it'll be beside the Lilo or the daiquiri and the all-inclusive holiday sort of. I'm trying to think what the word is, the pool side, that's what I'm thinking. The pool side edgy book. If teachers and leaders take away one thing from this chat, and perhaps one thing from the book as well, if they cross over, what do you hope it is?
The main thing is to focus on the children who you need to really understand, because they're complex. There's something that's getting in the way of them being able to access and thrive within your curriculum. And you need to understand the big picture of those pupils. The idea that this child, a child in year three, has been assessed as working towards, and therefore the new teacher should just be able to push them into working at, just by teaching harder, is I'm hoping something that people will move away from. They'll understand a child who is not succeeding with our curriculum, who's struggling within the curriculum, is not doing what we want to do. Ultimately, they're not going to get to at this point. Doesn't look like they're going to get to where we want them to get in Key Stage 2. That we need to really drill into the child, work out what's their journey been so far, which areas have worked, which areas haven't worked, which areas do we look like we need to make some changes for, and then make the changes for those children, and again, a few children, but try and make those children in a way that will be actually something that a teacher can do. So in the book, it's very much, you need a seating plan to understand what you're doing. On the other side of your seating plan, I suggest using an A4 sheet of paper or an iPad, a couple of pages. On the second page, this is what I'm actually doing. What I'm doing is I'm doing this for this child, I'm doing this for this child, I'm doing this for this child, for the group, for the class, this is what I'm doing. And that you keep a list of that, and it's really front of mind. We need to, at every point of the school day, do a bit more work on number, on division algorithms, on alphabet, on whatever it is. So all those little bits of time that you get in your class when you're lining up, when you're getting ready for things, when your child's finished their bit of work, you give them a task that will actually help them to do the thing which they need help with. So that's kind of what I'm hoping people will do. So really understand the big picture for a child and for the children who need it, and put those things in place so that something actually happens that will change something for the child.
Time spent on things that'll make a difference. I mean,
Yeah, absolutely.
sounds
Yeah.
fantastic. I look forward to reading it. Will you join us again? And perhaps some of the others who are regulars, if we read it and think, actually, there's a thread I would have untried
Oh,
there.
absolutely. I'd love to hear people's thoughts. And again, I'm hoping, as I say, I'm really hoping that it sparks a conversation amongst, primary and secondary teachers as well, to say, okay, well, what information is it that I gather that I find really useful that help, because there are areas that I probably haven't booked. As I say, it's a short book. I've made it quite focused, but I'm really, yes, so I'd love to come back and discuss people's thoughts.
Fantastic. All that's left to do really is to say thank you very much for joining me.
That's an absolute pleasure. It's very, very good to join you indeed. Thank you.
And everyone at home, until next time, thanks for listening.